This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. As you know, Terry Schiavo died last week after a years-long legal fight over whether life-prolonging treatment should be withdrawn or over who could make that decision on her behalf. We're broadcasting today from the campus of the Florida State University in Tallahassee, the city where many legal battles were fought. And this hour, we're going to look at the lessons to be learned from the Schiavo case. Will there be long-lasting legal effects, perhaps new state laws governing how end-of-life choices are made? What is the role of hospice in the care of the dying? And how do doctors determine the likelihood that severely brain-damaged patients will recover? And perhaps most important of all, has this case spurred us to talk to our family members about our own choices for the end of life? Has it motivated you to act, to put your wishes in writing, to designate someone to carry out those wishes in the event that you're not capable of doing that? And what does it mean medically to be kept alive? These are some of the issues, some of the questions we're going to be talking about. And if you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. And if you're here in the audience here in Tallahassee, please step up to the microphones with your questions. Let me introduce my guests. Jerry Maitland is an MD and professor in the Department of Clinical Sciences and director of clinical neuroscience at the Florida State University College of Medicine and director of rehabilitation at Tallahassee Memorial Hospital. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Nice to be here. Susan Ponda-Stansel is the president and CEO of the Community Hospice of Northeast Florida in Jacksonville. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
For driving to Tallahassee today.
Glad to have a reason to. Thank you.
Well, good. Thank you. Lois Shepherd Dahlenberg is professor of law at the Florida State University College of Law here in Tallahassee. You didn't have to drive too far.
No.
Thank you for being with us. Jeffrey Spike is associate professor in the Department of Medical Humanities and Social Sciences at FSU. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Lois, let me begin with you. We heard so much that much of the dispute in the Schiavo case centered around the fact that she didn't have a directive, including a living will. Is that really what this case is about?
No, I don't think that's really what the case is about. Now, an advance directive may have made the case come out differently. An advance directive can take two forms: a living will, which provides instructions, and a healthcare power of attorney, which designates the person who would make the decisions. Because she didn't have one, that meant that Michael Schiavo became her guardian to make these decisions, but only on the basis of her evidence, of evidence of her wishes. But in Florida, as in many states, a living will can only be used as evidence to withdraw life-sustaining treatment if you're in one of several conditions. And if the parents were challenging that she was in a persistent vegetative state, that was the condition under which life-sustaining treatment could be withdrawn. Mm-hmm. So in Florida, you can withdraw treatment like a feeding tube if you're terminally ill, if you're in an end-stage condition, which is like advanced Alzheimer's, or if you're in a persistent vegetative state. So one of their arguments that she wasn't not in a persistent vegetative state would block the effectiveness of the living will. Another thing is that one of their arguments was that she had changed her mind, that even if she would have wanted the feeding tube withdrawn at one time, because the Pope had made a statement about the necessity of providing nutrition and hydration to people in a persistent vegetative state, that she would have changed her mind, and they could still have made that argument as well.
Because she was Catholic.
Right.
And would have changed her mind.
That's right. Now, the court did not find enough evidence that she was a practicing Catholic or that her decision on this would be simply whatever the Catholic theology was on it. So they didn't give that much weight early on.
So what you're saying is that there really is no guarantee, even if you fill out the forms.
Oh, exactly. There is no guarantee. And in fact, the forms are often indeterminate. They're going to need some interpretation. So what you said earlier about conversation with family members, I think, is very important.
Susan, I see you shaking your head on this.
Yes.
In a hospice, is that how it works?
Well, Lois and I were talking about this prior to the broadcast. Even though these are imperfect documents, at least they are sometimes the occasion around which people can have these conversations that are often very difficult. And one of the things that we really try to do at hospice is to help people when they come into our program, come under our service, discover what their wishes are, and then make sure that those who would have some influence over their care are on the same page, or at least are comfortable that this is what my loved one would have wanted. But you think it would be something that would be a very no-nonsense, this is kind of, you pay your taxes, you talk to your family about
right.
this, but that's not the case at
so,
all.
So is it better than to have this conversation with multiple members of your family than in writing the paperwork?
I advocate that. I don't
Lois,
know.
Lois, is that, that?
I definitely think so. I mean, in this case, the problem was that the family did not agree. Many times the family does agree. And under the law, there's a provision that allows a family member to challenge the decision of a surrogate, which is why, we ended up in court, as most of these cases don't end up in court. But, you know, perhaps a conversation that had involved all of the close right. family members would have helped.
So you're having a family, you're having pizza out to dinner, and you say, oh, by the way, if I ever wind up in this state, don't keep me in this state. And that might be good enough.
Well, that evidence like that is similar to the kind of evidence that was brought forward in this case by Michael Schiavo. It was conversations that they had, in a casual setting. A lot of times people have these conversations after they see a movie about someone who is in a state that they'd like right. to avoid, or they've visited a family member. And so they're often not a planned session where we're going to sit down.
But if you have enough people at the dinner, that's what I'm saying, besides than just, yeah, even in an informal situation like that, yeah.
And Ira, I think it's important to recognize when people come to hospice, they know that their lives are at their end. So it's not uncommon for patients and families not to be of one accord. We spend a lot of time helping people get to a place where they are of one accord. I think the problems that we see are when the death is unexpected or the disability came before there was an opportunity to do this, and that's why I'm an advocate for doing it right away.
Right. Jerry, as a neurologist, do you have any idea how many cases like this of people in these sort of the same neurological situation as Terry Schiavo was? There might be around the country.
I understand that there's between 20 and 35,000 people with exactly her condition, and another 150,000 who have so-called minimal consciousness syndrome, which is just one step up from the PVC.
Define the two different stages here for us.
Well, if you operationally define consciousness as awareness of your environment, the brain is wired in a fashion that has two systems. There's an arousal system, which is confined to the hindbrain, and then there's the cerebral cortex, or the thinking part of the brain, if you will. And to have consciousness, you have to have both operational. Now, in the persistent, or and that's, by the way, we don't use the term persistent anymore, but in the vegetative states, the hindbrain is preserved and the cerebral cortex, the thinking part, is irrevocably injured. A little bit like having an automobile with an ignition system that works, but the motor's dead.
Mm-hmm.
That's the persistent vegetative state. The minimal consciousness state is just a step up from that and probably evolves out of these states, in which there's some evidence that the individual recognizes or interacts with their environment by looking, by touching, by verbalizing. But it is a very crude, rudimentary kind of response to the outside world.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Spike, we were talking about making these decisions up to the family to get together on what to do you think, as an ethicist?
Well, you hope that the patient has made their wishes known somehow. And the discussion so far, I agree that having written directions in advance doesn't always solve the problem, but it certainly helps to have it rather than not have it. So I would encourage people to fill out advance directives. But even when you filled out an advance directive, there can be disputes within the family. And certainly if you did not fill out an advance directive, there can be disputes within the family. When nobody knows what the patient would want when the patient has lost capacity, it will be a family decision. And it will be an easier decision if the family knows what the patient wanted or if they can come to an agreement quickly. And if not, then yes, that sometimes the decision can destroy a family. That's what we saw in the Schiavo case.
But it is typically the spouse who makes the decision in most cases?
The spouse in every state that has any kind of ranking, the spouse comes before the parents of an adult. So in that way, what happened in that case is totally typical and would happen anywhere. There's obvious reasons, I think, and it would make for an interesting discussion for the people at home listening. Why do you think that spouses always come before parents? And, you know, I think that a lot of people would come up with some very creative ideas and then say, yeah, I'm glad that spouses usually come before parents.
Susan, who normally pays for the care in hospice? In the Shivo case, who was paying for her care at the hospice?
Well, I don't know a lot specifically about the Shivo case, but I know at hospice, one of the things that we do is take care of people regardless of their ability to pay. So I'm presuming she would have received the care regardless. But the majority of patients in hospice, or at least in our community hospice in Jacksonville, are paid for by Medicare, Medicaid, or some sort of private insurance. But one of the tenets of our philosophy is that people get the care regardless of their ability to pay. So we have 5-6% of our patients who don't have any money and no insurance, and they still get the care.
I noticed that when Congress created the special federal law to investigate Terry Schiavo case, they didn't put any money in there to take care of her.
No, that's always the neglected part.
You know, talk is cheap, isn't it?
Absolutely.
If they had put some money in to take care of her, we might have started national health insurance because there are 30,000 more people like her. How could you do one and
not
the other?
Maybe
that's why they didn't put money in there. You never know. So do you see people like in her condition all the time at the hospice?
Well, I wouldn't say that we see people like her all the time. I think the Shivo case was an outlier, at least in my 19 years of experience with the hospice work. But we do see patients and families who have very difficult decisions and often come into our service perhaps having hydration, having feeding, and then as their illness progresses, we often have to have these conversations where we present information about the benefit versus the burden. And at some point, sometimes the burden becomes greater than the benefit. But hospice in general doesn't really have an agenda other than to see that the wishes of the patient are honored. So we do have patients who want full code, everything done, and if that's what brings them and their families peace of mind, that's what we want.
All right, we have to take a short break. We'll come back and take questions from our audience, from the phones, and talk more about these end-of-life issues. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about Terry Schiavo and end-of-life issues with my guests, Dr. Jerry Maitland, Susan Ponder-Stansel, Lois Shepherd, and Jeffrey Spike. Our number, 1-800-989-8255 is our number if you'd like to get up and ask a question here. We have a gentleman at the mic right here. Yes, sir.
Yes, I have a comment, actually. Our family has dealt with some of these issues with regards to my parents, and our daughter, who is a family practice physician, commented that it was very good that we were talking, that the issues are seldom as, or the situation is seldom as dramatic as it was in the Terry Schiavo case. We're not dealing with people in persistent vegetative states. The decisions have to do with, do you continue antibiotics? Do you go to a hospital for IV antibiotics? That sort of thing, and people need to be prepared for that.
Susan, you want to comment?
Yes, you make a very good point, because obviously the Schiavo situation is what brought us to this point that we're actually talking about these issues, but they are, although not as dramatic, often as complex, and they do have to do with what a patient's wishes and decisions would be about the various therapies and technologies that can be applied. And that's what makes this whole topic so difficult, because we have the ability now to apply a myriad of different interventions in the disease process, but oftentimes those bring burdens with them, and patients and families, number one, don't always get that information so they can really evaluate if the burden is worth it, and oftentimes they don't really understand the consequences of some of these decisions because they're not provided with information.
For example, how early up on the ladder that was leading to death do you start not giving medications and things like that? Would that be one of these things that you're talking about?
Yes, and it's really very individual, because hospice is based on an individual plan of care for each patient. So in the Jacksonville area, for instance, we have a younger than average population than the rest of Florida. We've had patients in their 40s who have feeding going on, who take antibiotics because they have some time. Their disease process is not at the end where they are actually imminently dying. And it's really a situation by situation, thank goodness, because each person's own situation is very unique. Mm.
In Florida and in other states, is removal and insertion of a feeding tube, is that considered a medical versus a nutritional, Lois?
Well, under the law, a feeding tube is the same as other life-prolonging medical treatment. And not just in Florida, but in every state court, and in fact in the U.S. Supreme Court, in considering the issue, has said that a feeding tube is like other medical treatment that people have a right to refuse.
Mm-hmm. Jerry, do you want to jump in?
Only to say that the tubes are inserted sometimes not for respiratory support, but for pulmonary toilet to take care of the lungs to make sure they stay open and clean and free of bacteria. So it's not always done as a life-saving method, but mm-hmm. sometimes life-preserving, if you will.
How much, well, have you, we were talking about the brain before, how much do we really know about how it works? You know, we make these decisions. Could these decisions change about, you know, our opinions about consciousness? And
yeah, I think that, the consciousness issue has been going on for 2,000 years, but we know a lot and we know very little. If you reference it just to this case, the idea of why we can't understand better this arousal system and reconnect it somehow is a real problem. Now, part of that has to do with the fact that people who are in vegetative states have such severe injuries above that there may be no receiving stations. But there are a whole lot more people who are traumatically brain injured, severely so, that aren't qualified as vegetative or minimal consciousness. And lamentably, we don't have good theories or programs, interventions, if you will, medically speaking, drugs mm-hmm. that might serve to arouse the brain. We're really in the infancy. So we don't understand the biochemical pathways that are associated with arousal. We know there's lots of neurotransmitters, but our brain's awash with those. So we don't have a consensus therapy for any of these traumatically brain-injured people.
Yes, I can't see you in the dark there, but speak up in the microphone. Yeah.
How do you really know when the full brain is dead?
Jerry?
Well, brain death is defined as loss of all brainstem reflexes and the inability to sustain respirations on your own. The issue of coma and brain death is not difficult. There's standardized features in that examination. The problems that I think are faced in ICUs around the country is the fact that many of these people have residual brainstem function. The issue is how much awareness of their outside world exists, and there's the dilemma. That's a very, very difficult and arduous examination, sometimes multiple examinations.
So there's a difference between that classical, what you see on TV is somebody being brain dead and just and the vegetative state that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think the main distinction is in a comatose patient, there's no waking. And in a case of someone who has a persistent vegetative state, these people will wake up. They have sleep rhythms on EEG. They open their eyes. They look around. It's kind of eerie to deal with these people, actually, because for all the world, you can go to the bedside and think these people are in perfect contact with you. And that's why the families get in trouble, because they enter the room with the idea that this beloved person is there. And so you build your theories around your data, not your data around your theories. Their theory right off the top is that this person's with me, and therefore their data follows. Whatever they mm-hmm. see, you know, seems to them to be real. That can be a very difficult examination. Mm-hmm.
Jeffrey, you were shaking your head there. You agree.
Well, a few thoughts. First, the question about brain death and also coma compared to persistent vegetative state. I've heard so much discussion in the past few weeks where people accidentally used the wrong word. And I think it's...
Accidentally? Are you sure?
Well...
okay, I'm sorry. I don't know what came over me.
Sometimes,
okay.
Accidentally. but that when you are in the room with somebody in a persistent vegetative state, it is really very dramatic. If you've never seen it before, you will be surprised. I think even if you're forewarned, you'll be surprised at how they open their eyes, they move their head, their eyes, they will grunt or make sounds. And as Dr. Maitland said, if you're a family member looking for hope, you can interpret everything differently. So the doctors see a grunt or a groan. The family can see a patient that's struggling to talk.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a call or hire. Mary Lee in San Diego. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. Yes, I have a question about the imaging techniques on the brain and how well that correlates with the clinical observations, and then how much better a PET scan would be than an MRI at detecting brain activity.
Jerry, we've seen that's a good question, Mary. Two parts. I'm going to break it out. We've seen pictures of her brain scan, of Terry's brain scan, and you can see a dramatic difference between her brain and a normal brain. Can you tell a vegetative state just by looking at an image like that?
Well, the problem with conventional imaging is it looks at structure, not function. So the answer is no, despite the fact that it may look horrible. The scans that were shown on TV showed these large ventricles. Now, those are just containers of water, and as your brain is losing neurons that have been irrevocably damaged, the ventricles expand just to fill up space. And that's what those, quotes, bags of water were that they showed in the CT scans. To come to the issue, are there better techniques? And that's a great question. PET scanning is a technique, of course, where positrons in a where a tagged element is hooked on to glucose, injected, and then you can analyze those parts of the brain that take up glucose, which presumes that they are metabolically still alive and active. I think that's a technique that has some role. It's been used a little bit. The problem is you need a linear accelerator to get an isotope, and not everyone has those in rural communities, and there's not work done on it. I think in the future, and I'm not a technologist, but MRI functional scanning, a technique where an MRI can be used to see what part of the brain responds to different stimuli, tactile, visual, auditory, is probably going to be the technique that we will see come down the road. Again, right now it's basically used in research facilities. But if I had to make a guess, that would be the technique mm-hmm. that will probably be developed.
Thank you, Mary Lee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have a good weekend. The next news blip we're going to hear out of this case is going to be the autopsy report. Are any brain autopsy statistics going to tell us, shed any more light on her vegetative state?
No. I don't know how to answer that beyond that. She's going to have horribly damaged cerebral hemispheres. But again, the issues are more complex. The fact that they're damaged doesn't mean that there was no function there.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to this side of the room. Yes, ma'am.
Hello. My name is Juanita from Tallahassee, and I'd like to know what you think about the difference between the living will and the five wishes, and legally is one more binding than the other? And does one appease the family members better than the other? Thank you.
Lois Shepherd.
The five wishes document is a very popular document that you can get online. If you just Google five wishes, you'll
get a lot of other stuff too. I think. But we'll talk about these five wishes.
Okay. It's a document that's been created by a nonprofit organization to promote the usage of living wills. And the first two wishes, one is, and I believe I have this in the right order, one is the directions. For example, I don't want, this or that, like a certain feeding tube or a ventilator, those kind of things, in XYZ condition. And then the second one is the appointment of the person to make the decision. And then the other wishes are wishes about the kinds of things that you would want, like the kind of music you'd like played or whether you'd like someone to comb your hair or things like that. And those aren't really legally binding, but I think they help to, and Susan can speak to that better as far as the effect on the family. But the five wishes is effective legally. You can use that form. Hospitals have forms that you can use. The Florida statutes have a form. You can just photocopy that one. So there are many different forms that you can use. One of the important things is to make sure that you follow whatever the rules are in your state with respect to witnessing. You need to have, for example, in Florida, you have to have two witnesses, and they're not supposed to be the person you named as your surrogate or a blood relative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Susan?
Yes, our hospice program uses the five wishes. We distribute them in our area, and I think we've given out somewhere along the lines of 50,000 copies before the Shivo case, and the demand is such that we've kind of run out of copies. But the reason we use the document is because it is more user-friendly. A lot of people don't have an attorney or are very intimidated at the idea of even preparing a legal document. And I tell people, even if you don't use the five wishes as the statement of your wishes, it outlines topics around which you can have discussions and begin to frame some sort of approach that you want for your end-of-life care. So I think it's a great discussion tool, and it is legally binding, so if that's all you use, it's a better tool than some people find with other sorts of approaches.
Talking about the end-of-life issues this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, let's go back to the phones for a call. Jack in San Antonio. Hi, Jack.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm an intensive care registered nurse in San Antonio, and one of the problems I've seen in situations similar to the Shivo case is that doctors will offer either false hope or self-serving information to patients. I've seen a doctor talk a patient's son who had a medical power of attorney out of a DNR, a do not resuscitate order, just so he could practice placing a feeding tube. So our saying on the unit is that a living will is only as good as the person who's left behind to fulfill it.
Jeffrey Spike? You have to be vigilant?
You do. I think the living will, and by the way, I would say that every state has its own forms that they prefer for living will. So you can, I think, for the most part, if you have one form that's good in one state, it will be good in most states. But it would never hurt to go to your physician and ask for a form, because they're likely to have one that's the state form. So keep that in mind. Now, also, as Lois mentioned, there's usually space to name some particular treatments that you would not want if you're alive in a certain condition, and then separately, some place where you can name a person to basically fight for you when you no longer can fight for yourself, who you want to be your, depending on the state, sometimes called a proxy, sometimes called a surrogate. So I think it's very important to name somebody and then pick somebody, exactly as you said, who will be vigilant, who will be by your bedside, who will disagree with doctors if it's necessary, or will ask a lot of questions, and who will represent your wishes. One of the best pieces of advice I've heard about that is don't name as your surrogate somebody who cannot live without you.
Hmm. Jerry Maitland?
On a twist on that, I have two couples in town here who asked me to be their surrogate in lieu of their family. And their idea is that I was, at least in their eyes, capable enough to make the informed consent about their likelihood of survival, et cetera. I think that's just a twist on that story.
Susan?
I think we're, in speaking about the literal aspects of the question, there's also something that we run into a lot in hospice, and that is the training that our physicians receive. I'm not fond of doctor bashing, because I know that doctors are really trained to stop death and save lives, and it's very difficult sometimes for physicians to really see when the process of death has already started, or to be comfortable with the fact that sometimes the best thing they can do for the patient is to not interrupt that process.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to this side of the room. Yes, question at this microphone.
Hi. I sent you some email a couple of weeks ago, and at that time I had no clue that I would be facing open-heart surgery next week. And this morning when I did a pre-op, they gave me a sheet of information here saying, would you like, in these situations, what would you like us to do? And I'll only ask about one of them. That is, situation A would be like Shivo, where you're really vegetative, no hope of recovering, you're really dead. I mean, Shivo was dead 10 years ago. Then there's situation B and C, which says you're B is you're out of it and you're going to die, it's terminal. Situation C was you're out of it, you can't communicate, and to read from here, the condition is permanent and cannot be improved or cured, but is not terminal. My wishes are, and then they give you eight different possibilities. My question to you all, particularly to the technical part here, is how do you know it's permanent, and how do you know that if you're kept alive for, say, 10 years, suddenly you won't wake up?
Jerry, I got 30 seconds before the break. we'll come back and get a long answer. Give me the short answer. You can think about it over the break.
Yeah, it depends on what went wrong with you. If you have a cardiac arrest, if you're out 6 months and you haven't woken up, your statistical probability is probably zero. If you have a traumatic brain injury, it's better than that. If you're still vegetative at 12 months, your statistics drop dramatically. So you hang in there with traumatic brain injuries. Post-hypoxic events from arrest are terrible. At 3 months, you call it quits.
All right. We'll come back and talk more about that with Jerry Maitland, Susan Pondostanzo, Lois Shepherd, and Jeffrey Spike here in Tallahassee. More questions from the phones and from the audience. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about end-of-life issues with my guest, Dr. Jerry Maitland of Florida State University College of Medicine, Susan Pondostanzo, president of the Community Hospice of Northeast Florida, Lois Shepherd, professor of law at Florida State University College of Law, and Jeffrey Spike, clinical ethicist at FSU. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Jerry, did you finish basically what you were going to say before the break?
Yeah, I think so. I think that that in these kind of cases with vegetative state, the longer you stay unconscious, obviously your statistics drop. But it is certainly much better for traumatic brain injuries, young college students who get in car wrecks, than it is for a 50-year-old, a 60-year-old who has a cardiac arrest. If you're not awake in a couple of months, you're just not going to wake up.
One question before we go to the audience here. How young can you be to sign one of these forms?
Be 18.
18. If you're 17 and a half, that won't work.
But you can still talk to your family.
Good point. Let's go to...
Hi.
Oh, yes, step up to the mic.
Hi, my name is Debbie, and I have what amounts now to a comment to add to what Jeffrey said earlier, and perhaps Dr. Maitland as well as an earlier caller. And that relates to talking with your family. Don't limit it just to your family. Include your friends and especially your doctor. For those of you who don't like to go to the doctor, try. I mean, almost 30 years ago now, our family was in a similar situation as the Shivos. At the same time that Karen Ann Quinlan was in her situation that some of you may remember. And really what made the difference for our family, it involved my mother was a Catholic, and it was a Catholic hospital. It was, like I said, a very parallel situation to Karen Ann Quinlan's. But the difference for us was that my mother worked at the hospital where the situation was occurring, and the doctors were also her friends. I mean, they knew her, and she had a good relationship with them. I mean, so they understood the situation she was in, and there was never any question when our family decided that enough was enough. We didn't have any problems.
It sounds like, thank you. It does sound like this really was a unique case here. Well, if you're saying there are tens of thousands of people like this around the country, and we hear of one case, and we haven't heard yet of copycat cases that usually spring up from things like this, where other parents might say, hey, you know, maybe my wife's husband isn't taking care of her as well as I thought, but, you know, whatever the case. Lois, why, you know, is this truly a unique case? As she says, you know.
I mean, as far as the medical situation, it's not unique, but with respect to what happened legally,
yes,
it certainly
the
is.
Legal,
just
the legal part.
Right. With respect to the extent to which the Schindler family took their objections to the decision to withdraw the feeding tube, that really was unprecedented. Michael Schiavo originally began to start this process in 1998. So you can see how many years have gone by. And at first, the courts, I think they kind of bent over backwards or were really trying to keep the doors open, realizing that there was family disagreement and wanted to hear everything that there was to hear. But eventually, you know, they had to start slowly closing the doors because if not making a decision is also making a decision. In other words, if she didn't want to live in this situation by prolonging the decision for 7 years, you know, then we had gone against her wishes.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
In terms of
Jerry, go ahead.
If I could add something, in the uniqueness of the case, I think how long it was in the courts was unique. But in another way, I think it's interesting that three of the most important cases that people talk about when it comes to healthcare law and especially end of life were all women in their 20s who were in a persistent vegetative state. So before Terry Schiavo, there was Karen Ann Quinlan, and there was Cruzan. Cruzan also was a woman in her 20s in a persistent vegetative state. So,
Jeffrey, you're saying we won't hear about these in older people.
That's right. And the thousands of cases, most of them are resolved without going to court. But somehow when it goes to court, these will be very dramatic cases, mm-hmm. and they help set standards that get, you know, it's discussed, it's in the papers, and sometimes laws change or our understanding of laws change. So I'm not surprised that it got all the public relations that it got. I'm not surprised that it's generated all the discussion that it generated. It sort of follows in a series of cases with Quinlan and Cruzan. But everyone should also know that if this happens to you or to someone in your family, there are better ways to resolve it than the courts. And mm-hmm. if it's happened in a big name case three times in 30 years, it's happened another 50,000 times without going to court, and that's the much preferable way to resolve it.
Jerry, did you want to say?
Well, I was going to say one of the problems we have is we suffer a little bit from statistics on outcome. And there was a multi-society task force that looked at vegetative state. And if I remember the figures right, of the 650-odd people they studied, they only had a follow-up after a year of about 50 people. So no one knows what the natural history is. But their comment, as I remember in their white paper, was that no one who had a cardiac arrest who was in a vegetative state for greater than 6 months ever recovered. So I think in terms of family planning, what we really need is a database to give people, to give them a platform to jump up from, and we just simply don't have that.
Hmm. It'd be interesting to start collecting that data.
Well, it is being collected, and in fact, the other emotionally charged issue, of course, is kids who drowned. There's another whole group, and some people are now looking at vegetative state in children. Hmm.
Speaking of which, there's a young man at the microphone up there, yes.
I was wondering about what the difference was in, between people that were in, what was it called, a rarely conscious state or whatever that was, and a vegetative state. Do they just take the feeding tube out for both, or, do they do something different for the people that are rarely conscious?
Child in chronology only. yes, Lois, would you like? Give it to Jerry. I'll give it to everybody. Jerry, you want to? We'll just move down.
Well, that's a great question. And the answer is, if you have a child or an adult who makes any kind of responsiveness to you, and by the way, that the term you're using is minimal consciousness, which means that a child might, in response to your face, smile at you. Or if you ask them a yes and no question, they'll give you some kind of answer, or they'll reach out for something of interest. That's what they mean by minimal consciousness. There's a full press on those people. Once you see that consciousness has been reestablished, no one knows the outcome of those people. There's no epidemiologic data. So that's for what we call in the trade a full court press. We do everything to sustain those people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Lois, did you want to say?
And legally, the law as it is in Florida and most other states, would not allow you to follow its procedure to withdraw life-sustaining treatment, which goes along with what Jerry was saying, the full court press. Now, our constitutional rights may be larger than those statutory rights. So perhaps someone could say they had a constitutional right to refuse feeding if they were in a minimally conscious state for a very long time. I think our expectation is that if there's any new law that's going to come out of the Schiavo case, that it's going to be in requiring a writing or restricting the ability to remove feeding tubes more or something like that. But one thing I think we haven't talked about much is, well, maybe we want to expand the category of cases in which a feeding tube could be withdrawn. For example, if she had been in a minimally conscious state, and of course that's not what the evidence was. It was that she was in a persistent vegetative state. But if she was in a minimally conscious state for 15 years and was not going to improve from that condition, mm-hmm. I think some people would want a feeding tube withdrawn at that point too.
Well, that leads up to my next question. And in all cases such as these, and let's expand it because she is not a unique case, is the best thing to do to remove the feeding tube if she's on her way to death and you're easing her death? Is this a painful way to die from lack of nutrition? That's what we've heard, this hot-button issue. She's dying of thirst. She's dying of nutrition. Is she in any pain at all, Lois? Susan?
Well, I can't comment on Terry specifically,
right.
But one of the things that we see all the time with hospice patients is that there is a very natural process that starts as the body begins to die, and we actually spend a lot of time educating patients and families about what to expect. The patient will withdraw, their extremities may become cold, they eat less, they may refuse food completely. So there are times when the process of the body leaving this world has already started, that to put those artificial things in actually can become very uncomfortable and a burden on the patient. There are other times when the patient has some time left, when they're not in the dying process, that those procedures can actually give them the quality of life so that they can have some time with their family and have some time to do the things that will bring them peace of mind. So it's a yes, no, and maybe answer to that question.
Jerry?
I don't want to misquote this, but a few years ago there was a very nice review from Oregon hospice nurses on and basically the paradigm was two groups of individuals who were dying of cancer, I think, but in any case they were dying. And they were offered either pain medicines, food, and nourishment and drink, or they were allowed to withhold drink and food. And at the end of the period of time, the death rate was about the same at 2 weeks. Qualitatively, the families and the hospice nurses clearly felt that the individuals who had withheld food had a much smoother, more comfortable death period, to the point where there was an editorial that accompanied that article in the New England Journal that said that they were concerned about releasing this, because what they learned in after 24 hours of being withheld from drink and food, there was no thirst and there was no hunger. And their concern was that old people, isolated, without family, without a lot of means, would pick up on this and realize that they could commit suicide simply by withholding food and drink for 24 to 36 hours, after which time they would no longer suffer.
Yes, Susan.
Just to follow up on what Jerry said, one of the things that we do see, and as a layperson, I can explain it as I understand it, as people are in the dying process, it's almost like a car whose engine is not turned on at all. If you keep putting gas in the tank, the gas isn't needed. The tank eventually overflows. And what happens a lot of times if people continue to take this hydration and nutrition and their bodies are actually dying, it can be a very uncomfortable situation. It can actually be a harder death, but it is case by case.
Let's go to the young woman sitting here, standing at the mic. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a graduate student in international affairs, and I was actually in Germany when the case broke last year. And so my question is, how do we approach end-of-life issues compared to other countries?
That's a tough one. I can.
You haven't shied away from any of them yet.
Yeah, so. Well, that's why we're here. It depends on which country you look at and who you ask, but I know in Europe, for instance, particularly England, hospice and providing care to people at the end of life is done completely differently than we do here in the United States. So much of it depends on the culture of the nation, the culture of the person, religious issues come in. So everyone approaches it differently. But the one thing we have seen, because we've worked with people from the Far East, South America, for many countries, death is a closer experience than it is for Americans. It doesn't take place in a hospital away from loved ones in a critical care unit. It's something that people live with and sort of accept much easier than we tend to do so in the United States, because it is a fact of life, because they don't have the resources that we do to intervene at the end of life.
We're talking about the end-of-life issues this hour at Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Lois, did you want to jump in?
I don't know a lot about the international scene on the end-of-life legal decision-making, but I do know recently I've read about Great Britain and the law there, and they do not followed the American procedure of looking to the family to make the decisions out of court. So if you're in a persistent vegetative state, it's the doctor's decision as approved by the courts. So that's a very different approach. Our approach here in the United States, I know it might not seem that way because this case went to court, but our approach has been to work with the family and to try to effectuate the patient's wishes.
Yes, young man at the mic here.
Hi, my name is Jerry. I just have a quick legal question. In light of the action of Congress and the President, how many of these battles are going to be moving on to a federal level because of the Schiavo case?
I think we don't know the answer to that question yet. The law that was passed with respect to the Schiavo case just dealt with her case.
But is that now a legal precedent for individual cases? Could it be on abortion or any other stem cells or anything else like that?
Well, the federal courts already have jurisdiction to listen to cases involving constitutional claims. They generally step away from these kinds of cases because these are generally decided in state courts. They have the mechanism, a state statute. If the federal court had looked more closely at the case, which they didn't feel it was necessary to, because basically the argument was that there hadn't been enough process, and they said, well, there's, you know, been plenty of process. So I don't think the federal courts want this, and I think if there's going to be a change, it's going to not just be a change about what court it would make the decision, because the court, like the federal court, would have to apply the state law. So there was no suggestion, I guess there was a suggestion by the legislature that the state court had misapplied the Florida law, but every other court had said that the Florida courts had done a good job.
Mm-hmm. I got about a minute left. Anybody want to take a stab at what the ultimate legacy of this case is going to be? Let me ask you, Jerry, medically, you have any?
No, I think it taught us that we're still at a stage where the clinical examination in this particular entity makes the decision. And we are hostage to our emotions, both as neurologists and as family. Mm-hmm. I think technologically this will spur development, I hope, of more appropriate functional tests, perhaps, and maybe spur some interest in some funding for research in drug therapies for patients in coma and near coma. Mm-hmm.
Jeffrey, any quick?
The one thing I would worry about would be that as a result of this case, some states try to raise the standard of evidence that we need before you can stop life-sustaining treatment, specifically say that you have to have written down what you would want.
Notarized.
And I think that would lead to a lot of tragedies. The saying that one hears bantered about very loosely is that we should err on the side of life, but that can be an error too, and it can create a lot of harm. So I think we're better off with the system that allows us to try to decide what the patient would want without requiring that it be a written directive.
Susan, 10 seconds.
I think the legacy that we're already seeing just by you having this discussion today is that people realize that they could be in this situation, that none of us are exempt, none of us gets out of this life alive, so that we need to have these discussions and
okay.
put it down.
There you have the last word. Susan Ponder-Stansel, Jerry, Maitland Lois, Shepherd, and Jeffrey Spike, thank you all for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The program is produced by Ed Heist, Erica Altman, and senior producer Karen Berghoff. Charles Berkowitz is our director and web producer. Our interns are Corey Binns and Todd Neal. And we had help today from Sarah Spivak and Megan Moline in Washington. Surf up to our website at sciencefriday.com. If you missed any of the references we talked about today, you can get them there. Charles has them up. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection. We make free curricula about everything on Science Friday. Very interesting stuff today for teachers. Click on our teachers button there, and you'll be able to download the free teaching materials. Also, you can now podcast Science Friday if you want to surf over and get some podcast material. Also, Real Audio and Audible.com. I'm Ira Flatow in Tallahassee.